Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here. I got another fabulous podcast for you today. Apologies for the slight delay between the episodes. I really prefer doing podcasts face-to-face rather than via Zoom. I spend enough time in Zoom, so I was hanging out for the Sydney lockdown to be over, which it is, so that's awesome for us. Yeah, so Nikki Jackson is my guest. Nikki is the CEO and founder of RangeMe. So yeah, I popped up to her house in Dover Heights from my abode in Bondi Junction. And yeah, we go right into the story. So RangeMe is, you know, it's been described as a dating app for retailers and consumer goods brands. Nikki started the company quite a few years ago. I think it was about 8 years ago. She sold it in 2017 to a private equity group, Efficient Collaborative Retail Marketing. She's still running it. Company's going very, very well. She moved the whole family to San Francisco, because most of their customers and focus was in the US and still is, but she's now running the business from here. She works with her husband, Daryl, who I know pretty well, an awesome dynamic duo behind the business. Yeah, and look, it's just a great story of tenacity, hustle, great product focus, great team culture, internationalization, how to move your family across the world and still stay same. Yeah, so she was back in Sydney. We had a great chat, loved doing it face-to-face. A couple of interruptions from the dog Rocket. We got pretty excited that someone was there to pat him. So I really enjoyed it and I hope you do too. Here's my chat with Nikki. All right, welcome to the show. I am amazed to be face-to-face once again. I can't remember how long it's been since I've done a face-to-face podcast. I much prefer it. I am at the fantastic home of Nikki Jackson. I'm up in Dover Heights. Thank you for having us, Nikki.
Thank you for coming.
You have a beautiful house.
Thank you.
Yeah. It reminds me a little of Dave Shane's house. That was one of the last podcasts I did. And there's a link with David that we'll talk about. So Nikki, you are the CEO and founder of RangeMe. That may not be super well known within the Australian ecosystem. It should be. And that's part of the reason I really wanted you on the show, because it's an amazing story. Look, I mean, maybe we can just start with the easy question, you know, what is RangeMe? And we'll go from there.
Sure. And you're absolutely right. Not very well known in the Australian ecosystem, but very well known across the United States. And just a bit of my background. So my background is in the FMCG or CPG space. So I spent many years working for big multinational brands like Kellogg's, Pepsi, Jim Beam, and had a lot of experience bringing big brands to market. And when I was on maternity leave with my second child, my daughter, who had terrible eczema, I started to develop an organic skincare range for kids with eczema, and quickly discovered that when you are a trending organic or niche brand, it's very difficult to get a foot in the door at the major retailers. And I was used to having, you know, big brand names behind me getting the carpet rolled out at Coles and Woolies when you came in to show them your NPD. And there I was, Nikki Jackson with Derma Baby. And I literally had no contacts in the skincare space and was just cold emailing and found it virtually impossible to get a foot in the door. So I started researching the pain points on both sides from the retailer perspective and the supplier's perspective. And at the time, there wasn't a solution except for a physical trade show to help connect retailers to brands and brands to retailers. And I decided to take the money that I was going to invest in Derma Baby and actually launch a platform to help connect retailers to brands and brands to retailers. Because at that time, the market was shifting. If we think about 2012, 2013, it was a very different landscape in the supermarket aisles. There wasn't, you know, mainstream organic, fair trade, paleo, keto type products. It was very much, it was like the mainstays, the mass brands. But the market was starting to shift towards brands that were more meaningful to today's consumer. And so the retailers were looking for these brands, but there was no place for them to find them. And so RangeMe became that hub. And that's how RangeMe was born, literally in the garage of, sorry, not the garage, the toy room of our renter house down the road, where I'd put the kids to sleep and quick, I had to put a little desk in the toy room and I would just literally run down and start thrashing work out. And the minute they'd wake up, I'd put them on the mat, keep them occupied and continue to work.
And so, I mean, this is like the ecosystem existed back then, but it wasn't sophisticated.
When I told people I was in a startup, they were like, oh, shame. I feel so sorry for you. Like, that must be terrible. You know, it wasn't like we've come back from San Francisco and Sydney, Australia is a thriving ecosystem now of startups, where startups are cool and trendy and it's a cool thing to do. back then in 2012, it was not.
Yeah.
There weren't many VCs to even go to.
No, there wasn't.
No.
Well, and there was no support.
No.
You know, and what I wanted to ask about is the tech side. I mean, as a non-technical yes. founder, I mean, yes. I'm sure it wasn't easy for you to actually find the right people or the right agencies to build this thing. I mean, how did you go about that?
Wow. So we looked at getting people offshore to help us build out the MVP. And then we started looking within Australia. And I remember my husband, who then joined the business, and I can talk through that, Daryl and I had a frank conversation. We're like, we can find people from overseas to build out the MVP, or we can pay a little bit more and get someone locally. And we did find a development shop locally that were willing to take this project on. And we said, for the extra 20-30% we're going to pay, we're going to be able to have speed to market and be able to like work face to face with these people. And it was the best decision we ever made.
And I don't want to go down the technical rabbit hole, but did you end up sticking with that platform, or did you rebuild it?
So we stuck with the base of what the platform was built on, which is Ruby on Rails, which is the code. And we kept the development house on until we bought in-house our CTO and founding RangeMe member, Ricky Friedlander, has been an absolute rock star and with us from the very beginning. And he was introduced to us via one of our early investors, Dave Shane. And once we brought Ricky on board and started to build out the team, we did start to move away from the development house because we were building out our own team of engineers. So we didn't actually need to rely on them. And that happened once we'd raised capital.
Yeah. I always like sort of fast forwarding. I mean, I do want to cover how you got there, but look, where are you at right now? I mean, what I've got here, 1 million products listed. I mean, that is just a vast number. Like give us some metrics around where you're at.
So we have over 200,000 active suppliers in our platform, in our network. And these are suppliers that have got multiple products and multiple brands within them. So over 1 million SKUs. We have over 10,000 retail buyers that use the platform. Today, we work with over 75% of the leading US retailers who have partnered with RangeMe to manage every new supplier that wants to get a foot in the door of that retailer has to sign up through our platform. And we manage that process of new supplier inquiries and new products for those retailers that we partner with. So we really do own and dominate the landscape when it comes to the US market. Our origins were in Australia. However, given the size of the opportunity, we'll talk a little bit about that later. We abandoned this market a little bit to set forth for the US, and I packed up my family and my kids in diapers and moved over to the US like a mad woman. But it was all worthwhile. And since we've globalized the platform more recently and launched into the UK, we have actually reinvigorated the Australian market because we want to globalize the platform and make it accessible for brands and retailers all over the world.
Yeah. And it should be noted, you have sold the business. I mean,
yes.
Was that a full sale?
It was a full sale, 100% of the business, all the shareholders, everyone in the business was paid out 100%.
But you're still a shareholder in the yes. new business? Or
yes. That happened in 2017. Only after being on the ground in the US for 2 years that we sold the business wow. to a private equity firm that owned our biggest competitor in the market. And
that's efficient collaborative retail marketing.
They called ECRM. It's a bit of a mouthful.
It really is.
But they've been, our chairman in the US, Idor Leffler, who's a very successful entrepreneur in the CPG or FMCG space, alerted us to ECRM before we even set shores and got into the US market and said to us, ECRM were famous for him launching Yes to Carrots, which is a natural skincare brand, which he launched, which was the second biggest natural skincare range in the US. And he said to us, keep an eye on ECRM, watch out for ECRM, you'll get to know ECRM. And he was actually quite amazing because we did that and they were the ones that ended up acquiring us. They're owned by a mid-market PE firm in New York City called Snowphips, a fantastic group of private equity folks who debunk the myth about private equity. We've been extremely happy with them as partners and it's been a really great journey.
And you had taken some investment before that?
I mean, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we raised a very early investment from Andrew Reitzer, who was the ex-CEO of Metcash for 16 years. Andrew was an advisor to me in the business and then came on board as an early investor. And he was actually our Australian chairman before we moved the business to the US. And he was really an incredible, sounding board for me, advisor to me, and also chairman, and helped us really in the Australian market because, of course, he had a really credible name when it came to the retail landscape. And so he was part of what I call like the family and friends round. And then Carly Shumgar joined as a founding member of the RangeMe team, and she also invested equity in the business. And at that stage, we then went out and raised external capital. We raised from CapZ, which is Zach Rosenberg and the Lieberman family in Melbourne, and also Monash Private Capital, which was led by Dave Shane. That investment, it was a consortium. Dave and Jeff themselves invested personally. And there was a consortium there.
Yeah. But I mean, David, for the listeners out there, if you go back, I don't know, 10 episodes or so, I did interview David, an amazing guy. I mean,
amazing.
Such a great backstory.
Phenomenal.
The nicest guy you'll ever meet. And
yep.
One of the best investors out there. I mean, he's our innovation fund now, and they're, I think, in their second or third fund,
yes.
And just
yes.
Smashing it.
Absolutely.
Really
absolutely. Really founder friendly.
Yeah.
I would... And I definitely think, get them on board again if ever I did.
Yeah, and I know that none of the numbers were disclosed, but what you're saying before, I mean, it was he got more than 10 times return on his capital. Is that
definitely? Yeah. It was a really great return for the early stage investors. We raised about $2 million in Australia, and then when we went out to the US and secured US retail clients, we raised $4 million in the US market. Freestyle Ventures was our, I guess, seed investing in the US market. They are very well known for seed investing. They invested in a whole lot of startups that are very well recognized. And we also got great investment from other people that were strategically important. So like Kevin Hartz, who was the founder of Eventbrite, invested in RangeMe. We had...
It was another husband and wife team, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I went to their office, I was absolutely blown away. There I was. We didn't even have an office yet. I went to the Eventbrite office in San Francisco, and I saw people on treadmills doing their work. And he just said to me, "Nikki, I'm more proud of my first office than I am of this office." But an incredible success. I didn't actually meet Julia, but I met with Kevin, and he was really fantastic. We also had Simon's Equity Partners that are big. They're kind of like the Westfields of the US. They're also invested in the business because they understood the CPG or retail landscape that we were conquering.
And just do you regret any of that? Did you sell too soon? I mean, you don't strike me as the person who could regret, but
no.
Let me ask it a different way. Could you have gone on to have built a billion-dollar business without the acquisition?
I think together with our partner, we are building a billion-dollar business. I think RangeMe alone could have got there, but we needed the arms and legs of our partner that we partnered with in ECRM. They had... had a really established relationships in the market, and they really were the horsepower behind our business. But our business is digitally transformed with them, transformed their entire business. So together we are an incredible team and partner, and RangeMe is the funnel for a lot of their growth. So it has been, what's nice is that it has been a great acquisition for them, but also it was a great acquisition for us at the time. At the time we were actually capital raising. And, going down Sand Hill Road in San Francisco many times to meet all the venture capitalists. And RangeMe wasn't necessarily a venture type business. It was strategically a very important business in the retail landscape. And it became really apparent to us when we had major enterprise software businesses in the retail landscape that were working with our biggest retailers coming forth to us saying, "We want to acquire you." And that was when that all happened, where we were like, "Oh shit, we're raising capital, but here we are getting acquisition offers." And we didn't get it from one strategic. We got it from several strategics where they were looking to acquire or invest in our business. And we thought at that time, a strategic partner was better than getting a venture partner. So we probably, if we would have taken capital, I believe we would have taken capital from a strategic. I flew out. I'd spent 12 hours in New York City to San Francisco and back to meet with the CEO of Nielsen, and they were very interested in what we were doing in our business. So these are the types of people that were really interested in what we were doing. And so definitely, absolutely no regrets, because the acquisition price gave an incredible return to our investors, incredible return to us personally. Yeah. And also it was a lot more than the value of what we were raising capital with at the time. So it compensated us for the upside and also gave us that security.
Yeah.
But we also had very, our investors were very supportive. So they were supportive of us wanting to continue to build and live out the dream and continue to do that. But they were also supportive of, what we had in front of us.
Yeah.
And it was actually you know, we had several conversations at night with Jeff Levy and Dave Shane, and, you know, they were like, you know, this doesn't happen all the time where you know, we were 2 years on the ground in the US. It was so quick. Yeah. And they're just like, this is incredible. Take the money and run.
Well, you haven't run. I mean, you took the money,
but you're absolutely still in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I live and breathe it every day, and I still love the business.
Yeah. And it's a great story. And I think, you know, that there's a lesson in there for the founders listening, because, I mean, we're surrounded by the Canvas and Atlassians, and they just, you know, the Atlassian guys apparently still own 70%+ of the business. And, you know, Canva founders are up there as well. It doesn't need to be that way. I mean, you can sell the business, you know, pay off the mortgage, have cash in the bank and not have to worry, but you can still have a great life with that and run a fantastic show. I mean, that's kind of the lesson that from you.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely life-changing for us financially in terms of the security and the stability that it provided us. And I think that, you know, I had to counsel a lot of our staff at the time when we did sell the business, because they were also thinking it would be the next Facebook or the next big business. And it definitely will go on to be that. But what you also have to counsel them is there's so, and also living and breathing it in San Francisco, there's so many businesses and startups that don't make it, that run out of funding, that do down rounds, that end up with, you know, people in the, you know, when it comes to the acquisition, many, many years later, end up with almost nothing.
Yeah.
Because there's all preference stock and preference shares and so much money being poured into these businesses that you end up diluting to nothing. So we were very aware of the risks and how it happens to a lot of businesses that people don't read about. You just read about the Atlassians, the Canvas. That's not every success story. And those have only recently come about. And it's incredible for our ecosystem and incredible for the name for Australian founders. But when I was doing RangeMe, Atlassian was the Atlassian deal had just happened. So that was great.
All right, well, we should go back a little bit, because I do want to hear a bit more about how you got to this. So where did you grow up and where did you do your uni?
Yes. So I grew up in Sydney and I went to UNSW. I did a Bachelor of Commerce majoring in marketing and human resources, but with commerce, of course, you have to do accounting and economics, everything which I literally dreaded for a full year. And my dad is actually an accountant by background. And I used to come home almost in tears saying, I just can't get my head around these balance sheets. I remember doing these big booklet projects and just teaming up with people just so I can kind of leverage off what they wanted to do. But I was like, this is like a means to an end. And during university, I actually got a job as a marketing assistant to the marketing director of Jim Beam. And for me, that is what really pulled me through, because that's what drove me and gave me the excitement. You know, I don't believe you can learn much from a textbook. It's more about the hands-on experience you can get on actually doing it in practice.
And you're obviously good in that internship because you got a job there. And it sounded like an amazing job. So you were at Jim Beam, which is a drinks company.
Yes.
And you're the brand manager and you're doing sponsorships. And I mean, it sounds like Party Central.
It was a bit of Party Central. There was a lot. It was a fun time we had. Yeah. Jim Beam branded vehicles and yeah, a lot of events. It was on-premise, off-premise, and I definitely learned a lot in the early days.
Yeah, and then like all good Aussies, you went to London for a couple of years. Like, how was that?
Yeah, I fled to London. I did 18 months in London. I traveled every single weekend. I worked for RHM Foods on the Bisto gravy brand,
Bisto,
which was
the
iconic UK brand. So like, which literally had an in-house kitchen where they taught me how to do the traditional roast and make the Yorkshire puddings, and actually now selling into the UK with RangeMe. Every time I have a meeting, I'm like, yep, I lived in London. I worked at Britvic. I worked at RHM Foods. And they just love that because I have that. I understand the retail landscape in the UK because of that time there. And yes, like any good Aussie, it was a great time to be and there and travel.
Did you get up to Scotland?
I didn't.
Oh, you traveled over the weekend and you didn't go to Scotland.
I know. Right, I went to Italy.
This interview's over.
My brother-in-law is Scottish, so we love Scottish people. And I promise you, I want to get there.
Right.
Yeah.
Just make sure you go in the summer. That's all I'd say.
Yes. He got married in a kilt.
Oh, there you
there
go.
You are.
Yeah. No, it's illegal not to in Scotland.
Well, he got married here.
Oh, well, there you go. If you're even remotely Scottish, then you should do that.
Exactly.
So then you started, I mean, there's a few other jobs that you had back here, which we touched on in your branding. But so 2013, you started. I want to touch on the San Francisco journey. Mm-hmm. You know, so you were here, you'd launched the business. I mean, what was the thinking process? Because you just started having a family.
Yeah. Well, my kids at the time were 2 and 5. They were very young.
Very busy.
We, as I said before, we had a chairman at the time who was based out in San Francisco. So how I got connected to him is quite a cool story. We got an article in the Financial Review when we launched with Coles, And on Facebook, I posted the article. And I think one of the biggest things as an entrepreneur is actually coming out and saying, I'm attached to this brand. This is what I've just launched, because you always have that fear of failure. Anyway, I was like, this is my debut. I'm posting this article all over social media. And then this girl, Natalie Schell, who's a friend of mine, reached out to me and said to me, you have to connect with this entrepreneur in America called Ido Leffler. And I'm like, Ido Leffler, I know him from school. His brother was in my year at school. It was like such a crazy connection. And he said to me, you're wasting your time in Australia. You have to get out to the US, because they worked in the CPG or FMCG market there. And they said to me, no one is doing what you're doing in the US. And also retailers in the US are hungry for innovation. In Australia, it was kind of the Coles and Woolworths show. They didn't really care about innovation or new suppliers. And so not that they didn't care, but they weren't as hungry. When you go to the US, they are hungry for innovation. They want to get the next best product because they want to outsmart their competition. And it's a very different landscape. And so he was critical for us looking at the US market and actually moving over to San Francisco, where him and his family lived.
Has San Francisco got some angle on retail, or was that just a good place to
so
be in tech?
It was based in San Fran, so that was a good landing pad for us. Tech, of course, at the time, VC raising money and also hiring great talent. Back then we had hired a head of customer support. No one knew what customer support was in Australia, like customer success managers. It wasn't even a thing, you know, heads of marketing that were used to scaling and digitizing and basically blowing up our whole platform. You know, those types of hires, I don't think we would have got anywhere else.
And this is the sort of heyday of the, you know, they affectionately called it the Aussie Mafia in San Francisco. Like, were you part of that whole Aussie crew?
A little bit. There? I mean, I remember sitting in our shared office and Mike Sharkey from Autopilot came in with his little backpack and we were chatting about, I'm sure you know Mikey and the team. And, you know, he started talking about Autopilot and we actually use their platform, their platform within RangeMe. And so I'm a big believer in their product and what they do. And so we had this little community of Aussie founders that were out there living the same dream that we were and trying to expand their businesses globally. But, you know, we also didn't have so much time for networking. It was literally head down and just go. I was literally traveling every week across the country to meet with different retailers, you know, working, you know, full on, Daryl and I in the business. We had the two young kids trying to settle into a new city, get them into the new schools and get them all settled in. But it was, if anyone was to do it, we were going to do it. And we actually thought about trying to hire someone to do that for us in San Francisco. And what we quickly discovered that no one can sell your business the way you can sell your business and no one can build a team the way you can build a team. So,
but there's definitely pros and cons. I mean, just even on the hiring front, yes, there's incredible talent, but it'll cost you a bloody fortune and to leave after 6 months. I mean, like, do you want to touch on that? Is that true?
To leave
the bit, like, so the tenure in terms of your staff in San Francisco
is actually short. We were really, really lucky. Like, we brought on people that really believed in our business and what we were doing and how we were trying to create a level playing field for all suppliers, give them access to retailers they wouldn't have ordinarily got access to. And we had a really great culture and a really great team who were big believers in what we're doing. Today, it's crazily expensive. Back then, it wasn't as bad as it is today. It was a whole lot more, but it was worth the premium. But we actually had our engineering team back in Australia and we did that on purpose because Ricky, our CTO, was based out here.
Okay.
But also, of course, you get the R&D rebate, which was important at the time. And also you could hire great talent and you didn't have to compete with the likes of Google and Facebook and all their perks.
Right.
And also we had some great founding team members. And so we wanted to keep the talent and the team here. So the main cost in the people in San Francisco was of course sales and marketing.
So is it true then that engineering talent is more expensive and more flaky in San Francisco, and that's maybe why you did it here versus the softer non-engineering skills?
Well, I believe now it's probably everything.
Right.
But I think a lot of businesses now have realized in order to raise venture capital, in order to be successful, you actually don't need to be based out in San Francisco. Like we are, because our business became remote during COVID, we're also hiring talent from all over America. We are hiring awesome talent out of Austin, Texas, or Los Angeles, or East Coast. And so we've realized that we can access talent everywhere. So it doesn't have to be San Francisco.
So do you still have an office in San Francisco?
Absolutely. Right. So we have an office in the heart of, right across the road from the ballpark, 665 3rd Street.
Nice.
I lived a lot of life there and I used to actually when we moved back to Australia, used to travel every 6 to 8 weeks, but of course we haven't been for a while. And unfortunately that office has been closed for a very long time through the pandemic.
But it's still there. So it will open again?
It definitely will open. We started to have lots of 15 people go into the office at any one time, and then Delta hit, and then we've kind of moved backwards, but we're going to be moving forward again. But it was an amazing, thriving office. It had a real startup feel, you know, the exposed ceilings. We had one office, and when we got acquired, we took over the next door office and bashed through the walls. And I remember the day we found that office. It was just it's got a lot of natural light, high ceilings, and a lot of great energy and a great team that used to fill that office up with lots of
And, you know, we're sitting in sort of mid-October here, you know, and I've just booked, I think I told you before we switched the mics on, like I'm booked to go to the US in mid-December. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rules still aren't quite there, but I mean, you must be looking to your first trip to to see it.
Yeah.
Right? Any ideas when?
I don't know. I was saying to you earlier, we were thinking July, like we're a little bit, June, July, school holidays, we're a little bit more conservative, but I think we will go sooner. I think the challenge for us, we want to go there when we can actually spend time with our team. And so I want to make sure that the timing's right. I don't want to go there and not be able to see all of the team. Now the team is based in San Francisco. We have over 70 in San Francisco. So we have over 100 in the whole team. But to see core team members, it's really important that we get to go there at the right time to see everyone.
Yeah. A bit more maybe in the pros and cons of San Francisco, because I mean, I'm sure there were reasons that you came back. I mean, the US is a, you know, very polarizing place. San Francisco is brutally expensive. There's loads of homeless people.
Yep.
There's guns. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk us through like how you maybe as a family or an Aussie family found that, and maybe why you came home.
I think at the time we had obviously sold the business. We had come back on a trip here for the first time ever in Australian summer. I don't know if you're familiar, but San Francisco, it's never really warm. It's kind of always foggy.
Yeah.
You don't really have the summer. If you want to have the summer, we would escape the city every weekend just to kind of get a bit of sunshine. And so we came back to Sydney for the first Australian summer, and we were like, oh, wow. There's, you know, every time we came back was during the kids' big July holidays, which was our winter.
Yeah.
Very, very different. We also, the school that we wanted our children to go to let us know that my son's year was getting fuller. My eldest, I wasn't entirely in love with the school system and the school we were at in San Francisco. And so there were a lot of combining factors, and the fact that we'd also sold and we had great people, founding team members still in the Range Me office that we could actually let run the day to day made it a lot easier in terms of the transition. And I just think it was really the right time for us as a family, also for our kids to be back with grandparents, cousins. You know, you can't put a price on that. And I think that we had done it in a lot quicker time frame than I thought we would have done it. And I think it was just the right move to come back. And moving back is never easy, but I just felt like we just needed to bite the bullet and do it, and also just have, you know, a place to call home. You know, we didn't have this house before we moved to San Francisco, and we actually came back and built the house, which is kind of like another huge project and headache. I don't know what we just like to punish ourselves, but it's all worth it in the end.
Yeah, no, it is. It is a beautiful house. I mean, we just look at it. It's a gorgeous day, and you've got a gunshot view down the harbor, you know, just up in the hills in Dover Heights. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I love this house. And so, yeah, it just was the right time.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Donald Trump had got in as well. And I think for a lot of Aussies that were over there, it's like, what the hell has just happened to this country?
He got in just like we were still there. So we literally moved. I remember the day he got in, we'd moved into our permanent place in San Francisco. And I went to bed saying, please let me wake up and let it be Hillary Clinton. And then I woke up the next day and it was Donald Trump. And people in San Francisco were deeply affected. We went to the kids' school to drop them off that morning, and they were crying and hugging each other. Like, you can imagine what went on. And I just thought to myself, selfishly, you know, as long as the economy stays strong, I'm here for Range Me. So long as the economy stays strong, I'll be okay. And thank God it did.
Yeah.
And that was my main worry at the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, America. I love America. I mean, we've got a place there, and it's an amazing country, but it's got some big issues.
Well, I have to say, my weakest moment was going to quickly grab lunch from the office down in San Francisco, south of Market, and literally was walking back to the office with my lunch, and I had dodged across the street several times, big highways of 6 lanes, just to like miss pods of homeless people that were gathering. And then a guy that was in front of me literally pulled down his pants, took a crap and pulled his pants back up right in front of me. Wow. And I got back to my desk. I said to Daryl, I have just gone to get lunch and I have just had the most harrowing 20 minutes walking to get my salad and walking to get back. I was just like, it was a very like alarming moment when that happened and very confrontational. And then another moment was our house was in, we lived in San Francisco in Noe Valley, which is near the Castro area. And my favorite coffee shop was in the Castro. And I took my daughter there before school and we went, grabbed in, you know, good Australian, have to find a good coffee, grabbed a coffee. And there was someone who was just basically mentally ill, homeless, and was outside the cafe, like just going mad. And I couldn't leave the cafe with my daughter until that man had been moved on or had moved on. And I remember she was late for preschool. I was late for my meetings, but I remember feeling so scared at that time and thinking, how fucked up is this place? Sorry for swearing, that we have, you have so much wealth and you have so much, so many successful companies and all these VCs with tens of billions of dollars. And then yet you have the disparity of like just people that are just lying on the street. And if you saw that in Australia, you would call 000, you would get help. Yeah. But there it was just like, yep, that's okay. It's just a homeless person. You know, like I've got many stories.
I'm sure. And I'm sure you've got stories about the health system. I mean, you know, Andrea injured a few times skiing and like the bills that you come away from, it's just astonishing.
Oh yeah, totally. The insurance, the cost of healthcare. It's just like, we are so blessed here. When you think about the medical safety net and like Medicare in general, the health system, it's just, yeah, it's phenomenal.
It is. You know, I complain that my GP will sometimes fax a specialist and it's like, well, that's not really that bad compared to the quality of care you get. Completely. So, but if you could fix the faxing, that would be
good. Yeah, that's a good business.
Yeah, there you go. Actually, we've been looking at a few in that.
I'm sure.
So you came back to Sydney and I think what you said before is it was kind of a transformation in the tech or the startup ecosystem. So, I mean, I'd love to hear your perception or perspective in that.
Yeah. I mean, when we left, actually one of our investors was one of the founders of Amazim, Christian Magel.
Oh, I know Christian. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Great guy. And he started inviting us to Digi Sydney dinners. And he was really trying to start up the whole ecosystem here. And we would go to a dinner and it'd be quite small. And then we came back and I went to a dinner and it was huge. And there were so many people. And I was like, that was my first moment of like, oh, wow. Like this is, you know, the whole startup ecosystem is a lot more advanced than it used to be. And just exposure to that, obviously still being in touch with Dave and learning about our innovation fund and what they're doing. And often, you know, a lot of my investors like Zach or Dave, or I'd often get flick decks and they'll tell me, not obviously confidentially, like, getting me to review things and looking at different startups. And so I gave me a flavor for, oh, wow, there's like a lot happening in this market.
Yeah.
And also the whole co-working spaces, all that was popping up and, you know, that wasn't a thing before we left.
Yeah. Now, look, I think it is night and day. I mean, I think Artesian came out the other day, not the other day, but a few months ago, and they said there was 115 VCs in the country and, you know, they just keep popping up. And you don't get money coming into the ecosystem without the talent there. So I mean, it's kind of everything has grown at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think the halo effect of the, you know, Atlassian in particular, Canva, Afterpay, I mean, there's some major, major wins there. And that, you know, WiseTech, I mean, like that money is flowing back into the ecosystem.
Absolutely.
You know, my question is, and I don't know whether you've got the answer in this, but I'd love to hear your perspective. Yes, we are doing well and we have grown as an ecosystem, but are we doing well, relatively better than the other ecosystems out there, you know? So is you know, maybe San Francisco has kind of come off its perch a little bit, but it was, you know, very high on its perch. But are we doing better than London or Berlin or Israel? Any perception than that?
I don't know. I just feel like we a lot better known and we have a lot more credibility and clout. And I feel like some of the VCs here are, and I know we can talk about a common one that in Flow, and I know that Chilix are involved in that. And we actually also invested in it personally. And I
didn't know that.
Yes. And
they've done well. Oh my God.
They have. But, you know, I was talking to someone in the US and I connected Dale to them and, you know, they knew of all the VCs that were behind Flow. And back in 2013 or 14 or 15, when I was there, they wouldn't have known of any names of US or of Australian VCs.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's that credibility factor. So I think that is what's put us ahead. I don't know where we stand, you know, relative to other markets in terms of dollars that we're injecting into VCs and things like into startups and that kind of side of things. But I would say that our name is you know, there's a lot of credibility behind.
I mean, part of me wonders whether it actually matters. I mean, because we're here.
Exactly.
And it's an amazing place to live.
Totally.
And we want to do the best by the ecosystem. So, I mean, yes, you know, maybe the competitive part of us all is like, well, wouldn't it be nice if we were world champions in the ecosystem? But the reality is this is the ecosystem we're in. Yeah. So shut up and stop complaining and don't worry about the other ones. Let's make this the best we can. That's, you know, that's kind of the backstory to Innovation Bay.
Absolutely. And I often say to founders, like, you don't have to get money. If you want to expand internationally, you don't have to get money from US VCs to do that. You can get money from Australian VCs that are very well known in the US.
Especially now. Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't have to worry about raising capital over there.
Yeah.
Unless you want to, because you want to help strategically place yourself and get introductions and things like that, which are more difficult for Australian VCs, but you don't need to do that.
So, I mean, this is an impossible question, but if you were to do Range, if you were doing RangeMe again now, do you think you'd have needed to go to the US?
Without a doubt. Our business never would have got to where it got to without going to the US. The market there is 20 times Australia. The retailers are hungry for innovation. There's so many brands launching all the time, creating a need, you know, and the US retailers also were leaning into RangeMe as a startup, as a female founder. They were interested in what we were doing, how we were changing an outdated and inefficient process. And, you know, we had big Fortune 50 or 100 companies saying, yep, we want to implement your software. That's crazy to me. To think how open, they're just so open-minded and they want to partner, they want to do business, they want to do a deal, they want to move forward. There's no tall poppy there. Yeah. It doesn't exist. And I absolutely loved living and breathing and working in the US market.
And you're confident now, can you do that as well from, you know, you are the CEO from here, but your market's over there. You haven't been able to travel there for almost 2 years. I mean, is that... I mean, what has COVID shown?
I think COVID has changed that. You know, I always had the mentality of like, I want my team to be in the office, and that's how you kind of, and I still believe that that's a great thing in terms of generating ideas and teamwork and team building. But what COVID has proven to us is that our business can be done. Our business is a virtual business, firstly. Yeah. So our staff and our employees and our team should be able to work virtually as efficiently as if they were face-to-face, which is, we've proven that because we've just had a few, you know, great years over COVID, which has worked really well in our business. So I think same way I can operate and be an acting founder and CEO from another market. And at the moment I'm selling into the UK and into European retailers. And 2 years ago I was on the ground in the UK, but now they're used to working remotely, and I can sell into retailers and have meetings via Zoom just as successfully. So of course, there is a place for face-to-face and that will eventually come back, but I don't believe it'll come back the way it used to be. So I think, you know, we've globalized our platform, and I think the whole world has globalized because of COVID. And hopefully, before COVID, being in the US, if I had a retailer meeting, I was on that plane. I was going there to shake their hands and look them in the eyes. And it was expected. And now I think that has kind of shifted.
And what's like in 5 years' time, like how much of what we are dealing with now in terms of no travel and more virtual, do you think most of that will remain in place, or do you think we'll be reverting a little bit back?
I think it'll be a hybrid. You know, we see some of the biggest trade shows in the US have started to come back, and they're not nearly as full or as busy as they used to be, because I think people have realized they can do business without them and that they can operate their businesses without the need for that. You know, so much travel. And you think about the disruption it is for their home life, for their personal life, for their health. I think that it'll be on a needs basis. I don't think it's 100% necessary.
I mean, here's a tricky question, because, you know, as humans, I mean, like doing this, I mean, like face-to-face is awesome. I'm loving it. But it's not as efficient. I mean, so I spent half an hour getting here. I got myself a coffee. We had a bit of preamble. I had to set up the gear.
Yeah.
You know, so instead of a one-hour Zoom podcast, it's turned into a two-hour thing. You know, so as a human, I'm much preferring it, but as an efficiency driver, and it's true in business too. I mean, like we went we went off and raised a fund this year, and that was really tough. But I actually think it was easier during COVID, because we had the ability just to drive that efficiency and loads of meetings, which we wouldn't have had face to face.
Yeah.
So I don't know, even know whether it's a question. I mean, I think it's just an observation. It's been harder as a human to be dealing with this, but as a business, I think it has been more efficient.
Absolutely more efficient. I mean, our parent company used to host 60 category specific sessions all over America to connect buyers and suppliers virtually. When COVID hit, they digitally transformed their entire business online. And I don't think it'll ever go back to the way it was before with the face-to-face sessions.
Yeah.
Because what they've realized is that they can do it so much more effectively, time-wise, cost-wise, everything virtually. And it is the way of the future.
So what is next? I mean, we talked about RangeMe being, you know, $1 billion company. Maybe you're there already, but I mean, like, what is the next few years holding for RangeMe and you guys?
Well, I think, you know, obviously we are private equity backed, so they will look to sell the combined entity in the future. And at the moment, our focus is really on expansion, so global expansion of our platform. We've just launched into the UK, into Europe. We literally announced today we just launched into the Netherlands with Holland & Barrett, one of the biggest European retailers over there. And so we are globalizing the platform. And so with that, it's globalization, monetization of the platform globally. And we have introduced transactions into the platform. So buyers can physically purchase, not just discover and connect, but can actually physically purchase and transact in the platform. So we have so much that we focused on doing and building out our platform and our capabilities that we have more than enough on our plate, and we're constantly growing the team. It's crazy to think how much the team has grown over COVID and how many employees we've onboarded virtually. So we are just continuing to focus on growth.
But you must be getting close to, what's the word? I mean, you're not quite a monopoly. I mean, you said 70% of US retailers.
Yeah.
So are you just talking about upselling within that or getting to 90%? I mean,
So we're constantly adding more retailers. So in different categories or different verticals. And in European markets, we obviously have just started working. So we've just started working with Ahold, Lloyd's, Co-op. I don't know if you know any of these retailers. And then we've got big ones that are announcing before the end of the year. Awesome. So we would just continue to expand that way and grow through that on the retailer side and just continue to add more retailers. And then, of course, on the supplier side, it's continuing. You know, there's new innovation, new suppliers launching all the time.
Family question. I mean, like, you know, I know Daryl.
Yes.
Separately. So you do work with your husband, Daryl, in the business.
I do work with my husband. If I had a dollar for every person that says, how do you work with your husband? Like, how did that go? And I think the biggest challenge with that is obviously everything. You're all in. So you're fully invested because we both were in RangeMe together. And so it had no option but to be a success because we had everything literally riding on it. But I think it worked because we also have different skill sets. Daryl's more COO, operational. He was absolutely phenomenal. He handled the entire transaction of the business on his own. So he literally locked himself in a room for like a few months when that whole transaction was happening and had 50 KPMG people doing auditing of the company, firing at him literally, and he was giving back to them anything that they needed.
Wow.
He was absolutely phenomenal, and hands down, I would not be able to do that. So we have completely different skill sets. I love building relationships. I love selling into retailers. I love getting people to say yes to me, and that's really my strength. And also, like, I'm a people person. He's also a people person, but he's more on the operational side. So the fact that we have different skills and we acknowledge each other's skills and we respect each other's skills and we respect each other that way, I think that's how it's worked.
Yeah.
So I think
it's awesome. And it's not without precedent. I mean, I think there's sometimes people raise their eyebrows. I certainly was nervous going into business with Andrea and with my Geelix hat on, but it's been great. And
like,
we have complementary skills too. And I think that's really important. And, you know, when you've got two with complementary skills, the answer is sometimes in the middle, or you just let the other side get on with
it.
But, you know, Envato, I mean, they were husband and wife team. Canva has done pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. But we actually had a bit of prejudice sometimes when we spoke to VCs in the US, and some were like very much anti it.
Is that right?
Well, what was that famous one? Shoes of Prey.
Yes.
They had a breakup
and
it didn't work out quite well for that business all up. And I think I don't think that had to do with it, but it's just for some reason there was one particular VC that I really, really liked, and he was just very much not a fan of the husband and wife team bit. But I think it can also work, as you say, in your favor. And if you think about in our business, in our platform, how many of the small brands that are launching, the innovative small brands, are husband and wife teams,
yeah.
family recipes, family brands. It's in every industry. It's-
yeah. I mean, and another example, I mean, Gelux had a great exit a few years ago with Store Reduce, and that was a husband and wife team too.
So, there you go.
Yeah, with a female CEO. I mean, so the woman in charge is...
woman in charge.
Yeah. All right, what have we missed here? I know we want to jump onto the quick fire round, but I think we've probably covered most of... I mean, this is an amazing story. I mean, I knew a lot of this, but I always love doing this because I get a lot more insight in it. I guess from my point of view, look, congrats on
thank you
and getting it here. Hopefully this will help just get you a little better known. And again, I don't necessarily think that matters too much, but just
it doesn't.
Being known, maybe it's good for hiring or
yes.
or down the track. But, mm-hmm. You know, thank you for being part of the ecosystem.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And thanks for coming home. all right. Look, we should do the quick fire round. And I always find that an interesting one. I did, I sent you the questions about an hour ago. Mm-hmm. So, that was quite organized for me. Normally, it's just before we switch the mic on. It's like, oh, yeah, I should tell you these questions before I stump you. So, yeah, first one is a book recommendation or your favorite book.
One that I've read recently during COVID was The Happiest Man on Earth by Eddie Jaku. He was a Holocaust survivor, and I've actually met him personally and heard him speak. And I just found it quite inspiring to hear how someone who've been through, you know, the depths of darkness and so close to death of just being starved to death and, you know, going through the Holocaust, and for him just to look at, you know, the happiness and the good that comes after that was just remarkably inspiring to me and just very uplifting.
That's great. That's
particularly during COVID when you think that, you know, you're doing it, you know, tough, and obviously everyone's done it tough through COVID, and you just read a book about the simplicity of happiness, and that really resonated well with me, and I recommend
it. Are you an avid book reader generally?
No, I'm so bad. Yeah. I mean, I'd love my kids to read books. I want them to be bookworms, and I have never been a bookworm. I do love getting into a good book, but it has to be very good in order to keep. I do a million things at once, and my attention span is not what it used to be. So I just, and also I don't relax. I don't know how to relax very well because I just love doing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, doing can be relaxing, I
suppose. Doing can be relaxing, exactly. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I would love to get into more books.
What about podcast? And it sounds like you have a good time for that.
Yeah, I do. I fleet in and out. I love listening to a good podcast. And actually, I was telling you earlier, I was Googling the one that you did with Dave Shane and then stumbled upon another one of his podcasts. And I listened to it last night for an hour. And this morning, I listened to yours and his for an hour. And of course, David's an advisor to me and I absolutely adore him. And I think he's a phenomenal tech CEO and like unicorn.
Yeah.
Exeter, and that also like it did it back in the day when it was just crazy in the 1990s or whatever it was. So I do love listening to them, but I also have to be referred as well because I also love listening to ones that are really good, and there's nothing worse than, you know, listening to ones that aren't good. So I've really enjoyed listening to your one with him as well. Obviously I love listening to How I Built This. I love Sarah Blakely and her story, the founder behind Spanx.
Right.
I was recently helping I love helping founders and connecting with founders. That's kind of what gets me really excited still every day. And a particular founder had a skincare brand, and I then started listening to the OPI podcast of How I Built This, and the lady that created OPI nail polish. And she was a migrant in New York City, migrant family. And I just loved hearing how that business was built and then became like a humongous success and ended up getting bought out. So I do love listening to podcasts. I love listening to ones that are basically founders telling their stories.
Yeah, great. News source.
I actually said my family WhatsApp channel. I have, between my sister-in-law, like everyone is, my Scottish brother-in-law, everyone is like posting the news, particularly on COVID, like COVID numbers or when the kids are going back to school. So I feel like WhatsApp is my news source. Sadly, social media is also my news source, including LinkedIn. So I find I get a lot of news source from there. And then of course, SMH is what I also tend to read.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No one's actually, I was, when you're talking there, trying to think whether anyone else has said their family group chat. I don't think so. That is a first. I love it. Do you have a favorite app? So this is like on your phone.
Yeah. I have. So I'm on the board of a company with Jane Martino, who's the.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
She's awesome. And she founded Smiley Mind.
Yeah.
And I just love, I'm not into meditation, but sometimes I find if I want to rest and calm myself down, I will listen to a quick meditation, but I also put it on at night for my daughter to fall asleep to. So that is a very much a well-used app on my phone is right. Smiling Mind. I think she's done a phenomenal job. It's a free app and the usage statistics are just through the roof. And I think people really need it right now. Spotify, because I think music is uplifting and it just changes the mood. And I love putting it on the speakers in the house when I'm cooking or, you know, if we're sitting around dinner, I'll put it on one of my favorite songs and start dancing with the kids. So I love Spotify. We've just ordered a Peloton. So I've got the Peloton app. We've actually bought stocks as well. I think it's a good time to buy stocks in Peloton, hint, hint. And I actually have started to enjoy the app. So I'm looking forward to using that more. At the moment, I'm doing one of the programs recommended by a friend. It's a core program. But yeah, I'm really enjoying.
That's great. Yeah, they've got a huge retail store that's just opened around the corner in Westfield.
Heard that. I'm looking forward to checking out when we can get to Westfield.
Yeah. Well, as of Monday, I think it might be open. And Karen Lawson, who's a member of the community, like she is now the Australian CEO.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Yeah.
She's been in the podcast several years ago now, actually. But yeah.
I'll have to listen to that one.
Yeah, no, she's great.
That's awesome.
Productivity tool is the next question.
Yeah. So I remember when we got out to the US, I remember someone recommends, like, you should start a WhatsApp channel with all the board members. And I'm like, absolutely not. Firstly, it's not secure, not private. But what I used to find is you just wake up in the morning to like thousands of emails overnight from Australia, from internal, like within the company. And actually, next to Eventbrite's office in San Francisco was Slack's office.
Right.
And this is back in like 2014, 2015, where Slack wasn't really a thing yet. And we started using Slack. And I absolutely love that in terms of productivity, you know, setting certain channels, communication with staff, communication with people cross border. So the Australian team. And it really significantly reduced the amount of internal emails and increased the collaboration between the team. So I absolutely love Slack.
Yeah, I used to lean in a lot more on WhatsApp, you know, because it's a bit more ubiquitous. And even, you know, maybe it's because the teams are very small. Yeah. So, you know, Gelix is a small team right now. Yes. We've got four people and we're bringing on a fifth. And WhatsApp's great for that team. But as it got bigger, so Innovation Bay, we moved to Slack and, you know, we've now got 10 people. So there's definitely an inflection point of around that sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 people that, you know, you go from WhatsApp, you know, omni-channel to Slack multi-channel.
Completely.
And it's been really brilliant.
Like we've got on our Slack channel, new supplier signups are in our Slack channel. And literally you can see since I've been sitting here, these are all the new suppliers that have signed up to Range Me.
So you must love that.
I love it. So I have a constant feed. And then of course we've got like, you know, Team Range Me, which is the whole team across the business is 129 people on that team. So, you know, we just got press overnight. We launched, as I said, in the Netherlands. So like we posted it so everyone can see it. Yeah. So it's just so effective and I love it.
Oh, that's great. That's a good one. And actually we had Carl Henderson.
Oh yeah.
He was the CTO of Slack. He was on the podcast a couple of years ago. So if you go back in that one, he was pretty interesting.
He's Aussie, isn't he?
He's a British guy.
Okay.
Came from Manchester, Birmingham, I think.
Okay.
Really interesting story.
Wow. The whole Slack story intrigues me because they didn't start out. They were actually...
It was like a gamer.
It was a gaming app or some kind of app and they realized they were going to fail.
Yeah.
And they actually were ready to hand the money back to the investors. And the investors said, we don't want your money back. Find something to do with it. And they had created Slack to communicate internally.
Yeah.
And that's when Slack was... It's like the most phenomenal story. Yeah, I think it's absolutely brilliant.
I love that story. A tricky one maybe for you, but who's your favorite tech CEO?
David Chain.
Ah, there you go. That's a good one.
Absolutely. I just think he's so founder friendly. Obviously, he's very much a people person and so much of what he says and thinks resonates with me, you know, when I think about his leadership style as well.
Yeah, no, he's a lovely, lovely guy.
Yeah.
That's a good one, actually. I agree with that one.
Not even a doubt.
TV show / movie.
I need recommendations. I love getting into and binging into a good show and I am looking for recommendations. So if anyone is listening that has a great recommendation for any good shows, please reach out. And I honestly couldn't think of an answer to this one because I haven't watched a movie in a very long time. So if you've got any recommendations.
Well, as of, you know, I'm pretty excited to, you know, when the the restrictions are off.
We're to actually sit at a cinema?
Going to the cinema.
Oh my God. Order popcorn.
Yeah.
Sit there, just lounge back and relax. Yeah. Like, can't wait.
And then in terms of TV show, like we did watch Inspiration Countdown. So it's the Netflix documentary on the Inspiration mission, which was the SpaceX mission with four civilian astronauts. So it had Jared Isaacman, who is a tech billionaire from the US, who basically paid for it.
Wow.
And he got three others who are just civilians. And it followed the whole documentary about how they went into orbit. And it was, you know, a 600-kilometer orbit, which is, you know, way higher than the space station. Spent 3 days up there, and there's a whole lead up to it. It's just fascinating. You know, so if you're at all interested in space, it's a five-part series, really, really good. One of the best documentaries I've seen in a while.
I'm going to write that one down. Thank you. Yes, there's nothing better than switching off, because otherwise I've just got my laptop literally in my bed or looking at my phone, and it's just, you don't get that time to just decompress and relax.
Yeah, good. And then last question, you know, if you were asked to do a TED talk, and maybe you have in the past, I'm not sure, but if you're asked to do a TED talk on a specific topic, what would that be? And it's, you know, so this is more around passion necessarily than it can be around business, but what would you talk about?
I mean, if it was around business, I would talk about the power of going global, the power of expansion beyond, you know, where you founded your company. So I think that would, because that was critical and turning point for us and our success. So I think I would focus on that. And if it was about personal, I would probably put around something around the fear of failure. Because as I talked about before, you know, coming out and posting an article and saying, hey, this is me, this is what I'm doing, was the biggest step for me. And it was the hardest thing for me to do, because all of a sudden you're attaching yourself to something. And people sometimes want to look and they want you to fail.
Yeah.
And so you and within yourself, you have that fear of failure. So I think I'll talk about the fear of failure and how to overcome that. Because I feel like so many people are held back from what they truly love and what they truly want to do because they have those little voices in their heads and they have that fear of failure. And I think a lot of it comes from, you know, willing to take risk and, you know, what is the downside? Like even with RangeMe, what was the downside? I could have just gone back to a corporate job at like a Kellogg's or a CPG firm or FMCG firm. Like that was always my fallback option. So there wasn't really, you know, they were of course risk because we risked everything, but it was, I could have always fallen back on that. And that's why I love listening to Dave's podcast with you. He talks about his crappy job was always his biggest success factor, because if he didn't have that, he never would have taken the leap of faith. And I think it was very much the same for us.
No, it's so true. And I think the hardest part, you know, for anyone listening that's thinking about a startup, that the hardest moment in any startup is having the courage to do it.
Totally. You know? I had thought of so many ideas and so many different things I wanted to do before RangeMe. And it's one thing to think about it. It's another thing to actually make it happen. And if I have, again, a dollar for everyone that says, oh my gosh, I thought of something exactly like RangeMe and I was going to do it. And I was like, okay. And like, you know, they don't realize how much like sweat, blood, tears, grit, you know, mental stability you need to actually run a startup, because it's a very draining, difficult thing to do.
Yeah. But it can also be a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun and it's a very motivating and it's like a drug. You just love it.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to stop, Nikki. So look, thank you. Thank you to you. And thank you to Rocket over there. It's a beautiful, fluffy caboodle.
Yes.
It was great.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that. And thanks everyone for listening.
Awesome. Thank you.